one tell them, so.
The title of Sunday Davies' talk is, I bow down to the compassion that arises for all beings. And it's a quote from a famous Indian Buddhist teacher called Chandrakirti.
Thank you. Yes, so Rat Negotia and friends, thank you for coming out on firework night. And it's also full moon, apparently. So I was thinking it's quite an auspicious conjunction of events to have a full moon and fireworks at the beginning of this talk, because I'm going to start by saying a little bit about a story from a Mahayana Sutra. And Mahayana Sutras have been described as a bit like transcendental science fiction. They're quite way far out. So I think, you know, perhaps if any of you have been out watching the fireworks, you've kind of been well prepared to drop into Mahayana Sutra for a few minutes. So yes, I'm going to begin by giving a very brief outline of a rather long story. And this very long story in translation comprises 383 pages of close type. And it's a story whose compass is vast, not to say cosmic. And it forms the 39th chapter or book of the Avatamsaka Sutra, the flower ornament scripture. And this last chapter or book of the sutra is treated as an individual text in its own right. It's called the Gandavyuha, which means flower array. And it describes the development of enlightenment through tales of pilgrimage. And I've read this whole chapter out loud a couple of times now. And, well, I reckon that is really one of the best ways to engage with a sutra, perhaps any sutra, actually, but particularly one of the degree of elaborate phraseology that this sutra has. So our story. The central character is a youth called Sudana. And the sutra begins in Shravasti in the Jetta Grove. So it appears that we're in historical time. But then it becomes clear that it's not quite like that. So the Buddha is in the Jetta Grove. And he's surrounded by 500 bodhisattvas, including Samantabhadra and Manjushri. And the assembly is waiting for the Buddha to teach. However, he enters into a certain samadhi, meditative state, and the Jetta Grove expands until it expands to the farthest limits of the universe, so that as vast as the universe is, it's contained within the Jetta Grove, and on the other hand, the Jetta Grove has become as vast as the universe. And innumerable bodhisattvas from the 10 quarters of space all converge on the Jetta Grove. They all start arriving from these different quarters in the universe. And they worship the Buddha and they offer verses of praise. And then the Buddha projects from between his eyebrows a ray of light which falls upon all the bodhisattvas and radiates out into all the 10 regions of the universe. And it causes all beings to be filled with a compassionate desire to benefit all beings. So in this quite magical setting for the sutra, which has really sort of taken us out of the human realm, though it includes the human realm, Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, is then depicted as travelling south, specifically to go into the human realm. And he comes to stay in a forest near a great city called Dharnakara. And people from the city come to hear that this great bodhisattva is living in the forest. So they start coming out of the city, hundreds of men, women, girls, boys, head off to the forest to seek out Manjushri. And amongst them is a boy called Sudana, whose name means good wealth. And the townsfolk find Manjushri at a shrine in the depths of the forest. And once they've all gathered and settled, Manjushri just looks out over the crowd. And he sees everyone's capacity to embrace the path to awakening. However, he particularly notices that this youth, Sudana, is outstanding, inasmuch as Manjushri can see that he's already formed an unhindered determination to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So Manjushri greets him, and then he proceeds to teach the Dharma to everybody present. And then it looks like he's about to just get up and walk away, at which point Sudana reflects out loud on the vicious nature of samsara, the vicious nature of conditioned existence, and his own spiritual ignorance. And he also extols the virtues of Manjushri and the Bodhisattva vehicle in many beautiful verses. And he requests Manjushri to teach him. And Manjushri looks at Sudana, fully taking him in, and says, and I quote here, "It is good that you think, having set your heart on supreme enlightenment, that you should find out the practice of enlightening beings. It's hard to find beings who set their hearts on supreme enlightenment. It's even harder to find beings who, once they have set their minds on enlightenment, seek the practice of enlightening beings. An enlightening being is to attain certainty through true spiritual friends for the realization of omniscience. One should indefatigably seek spiritual benefactors and be tireless in seeing spiritual benefactors, that is to say, Kalyanamitras. One should respectfully follow the appropriate instructions of spiritual benefactors and should carry out the techniques skillfully devised by spiritual benefactors without interruption." So Manjushri then tells Sudana to travel south to a country called Ramavaranta, where he's told to go to a mountain where he'll find a monk called Megashri. So Manjushri says, "Go to him, go to this monk, and ask him how an enlightening being should learn the conduct of enlightening beings and how to apply it. How one is to fulfill, follow, carry out, keep, and expand the practice of enlightening beings, that is to say, bodhisattvas. And how a bodhisattva is to fulfill the sphere of universally good action." So we're told that Sudana is pleased, enraptured, transported with joy, delighted, happy, cheerful. He lays his head at the feet of Manjushri in respect and circumambulates him hundreds of thousands of times with a mind full of love for the spiritual friend. And he weeps as he departs, weeps with joy, not with sorrow. And he commences on what turns out to be just the first stage of a great journey in which he travels far and wide over the course of countless years, seeking now one, now another spiritual friend. And each person he meets shares with him the spiritual truth, the spiritual truths that they've mastered and realized. And then they point him in the direction of someone new. And so eventually he comes full circle and he meets Maitreya, who is the future Buddha or the Buddha to be in the future. And Maitreya permits him to enter what's called Vairochana's tower. And within this tower, Sudana has a direct experience of the Dharma Dhatu, the realm of reality. And having had this experience, Maitreya then sends him back to his first benefactor, Manjushri. And so he meets Manjushri again, who then sends him to meet the last spiritual friend, Samantabhadra. And he learns the 10 vows of the Bodhisattva from Samantabhadra. So by the time Sudana meets Manjushri for the second time, he's visited no less than 50 different spiritual friends in his desire to learn the conduct of the Bodhisattva. Now, a small minority of these spiritual friends are monks, whilst nearly half are female. Some are young, some old. They come from all walks of society. They're experts in various professions, arts and sciences. And many of them teaching surroundings and formats that are not overtly associated with what is conventionally thought of as religion. Nevertheless, they're undoubtedly Dharma practitioners who honour and revere the Buddha. And they're known to each other through their spiritual practice, through their spiritual experience. And we can say that between them, they constitute a spiritual community. Now, however profound and far-reaching their understanding, and I can assure you, if you've not read any of this material, if you start reading it, you'll find that they've all got the most remarkable experiences, really very profound experiences. But however profound their understanding is, none of them claim to hold the whole truth. And their humility is striking. And after they've taught Sudna all they know, each in their own way gives utterance to the same sentiment. And I'm just going to give you an example of just one of them, just to illustrate the kind of the way in which they each express this similar quality of, well, I know this, but there's so much more to learn. So Megashri is the first person that Sudana has visited, and after Megashri has taught him all he knows, all he's realised, he says, "Son, from this universal light, in which is concentrated the information of all sense objects, I have attained the mindfulness of the Buddhas. But how can I know the practice or tell of the virtues of the enlightening beings who have purified the sphere of endless knowledge? Go, son. South of here is a place called Sagaramukha, where there lives a monk called Sagaramega. Go to him and ask him how an enlightening being is to learn and accomplish the conduct of enlightening beings." And just as a spiritual friend Sudana meets are characterised by humility, so too is he. He puts into practice what he learns from each person, and yet at no point does he settle down in what he learns and masters. He's ever open to the new, the unknown. He's aware of the limitless field of activity of the Bodhisattva, the vast play of the Bodhisattva. And the pattern set from Sudana's first inspiration for enlightenment until his final meeting with Samantabhadra is reflected in the refrain he utters again, again and again as he meets these different friends. He says something like this: "I have aroused the determination for unexcelled complete enlightenment. How would you have me learn the path of enlightening beings and carry out the practice of enlightening beings?" So the humility of both Sudana and the spiritual friends he meets goes hand in hand with a profound spiritual receptivity. Not only that, Sudana is clearly passionate about spiritual life. He manifests intense yearning, intense longing for truth, for liberation. His whole being is oriented to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So there's a real passion, desire, thirst even for the truth, for understanding. He's wholehearted, totally committed to the Bodhisattva path. He's single-minded and willingly puts out a huge effort to find the various spiritual friends he's directed to. And once with them, he's entirely receptive to them. And as a consequence, he rapidly masters for himself what they teach. So he embodies a perfect combination of activity and receptivity, engagement and letting go. Sudana reflects the unbounded energy of the creative mind, which begins to increasingly unfold after we have entered the stream, after the bodhicitta has arisen. So what will support the emergence of such unbounded energy? Well, it's precisely this rhythm of engagement and letting go, activity, receptivity, conscious effort, and then opening, just opening. If we're forever striving, whether in our meditation practice or any other area of our life, this is going to set up a strain in our system. And sooner or later, we're likely to have a reaction to this kind of continual effort. And we'll want to abandon making any effort at all. Now, at the point when we meet Sudana in the story, He's already mastered the art of combining activity with receptivity. But to the extent that we haven't yet mastered that art, and probably most of us haven't yet, it helps to deliberately create a space of not doing anything in particular, which gives room, as it were, for something new to emerge in awareness. Sudhana may not need this, but we probably do. We need times when we have no agenda, times when we just sit with what is. We just sit with ourselves. We just let things be. We just sit with what's happening within the mind, abandoning all judgments and expectations of what we think should or ought to be happening. And this allows space for something new to arise. It allows us to more readily experience the fruits of the efforts we've been putting in. If any of you have dipped into or read Ratnaguna's excellent book on reflection, one of the things he talks about quite early on is learning to do nothing and how it's an essential part of the peace. Letting a space open up in which the mind has room to move in new ways. And way back in 1978, Sangharakshita recommended in his talk, A System of Meditation, that we alternate periods of just sitting with periods of conscious effort. So if we've been putting effort into trying to concentrate our minds on the breath or develop loving kindness through the metta bhavana, then he was suggesting way back then, well, do some just sitting between sessions of active effort. So yes, just sitting in that context may just be a few minutes at the end of a period of mindfulness of breathing or metta bhavana, just to sit with the fruits of the efforts you've put in. Just sit and experience the net effect of doing that meditation. Don't just end the meditation and get up and go. And on a longer retreat, well, we may be doing several sessions of just sitting over the course of the day. It may even be the predominant emphasis of the whole retreat. Or it may be that we're cycling through different meditations, some requiring conscious effort, others just sitting, just being. Subhuti gives a succinct definition of receptivity, spiritual receptivity, as consisting in an openness to the progressive trend in conditionality, whether arising in oneself or in the world around one. So that's what Bhante has called the spiral path. And in particular, spiritual receptivity is concerned with the higher reaches of this path, what unfolds in dependence upon a direct experience of reality, what is technically called yata bhuta jnana darshana, knowledge and vision of things as they really are. In the Bodhisattva Ideal series, Bhante speaks of spiritual receptivity as being of utmost importance, and that without it, spiritual progress simply cannot be attained. And he suggests we need to hold ourselves open to the truth as a flower holds itself open to the sun. This is what spiritual receptivity means, he says, and here I quote Bhante. Holding ourselves open to the higher spiritual influences that are streaming through the universe, but with which we are not usually in contact, because we usually shut ourselves off from them. We should be ready, if necessary, to give up whatever we have learnt so far, which isn't easy by any means, and to give up whatever we have become so far, which is still more difficult. Receptivity means being prepared for a radical change in one's whole mode of being, one's whole way of life, one's whole way of looking at things. We resist this. We protect ourselves against this. So I was thinking that, well, one way we protect ourselves against this is filling our lives from dawn to dusk with endless activity, aided and abetted by the ever-present internet, iPad and mobile phone. Even when opportunities open up for pauses, we can so readily and unthinkingly fill them. Standing at a bus stop, waiting for a train, being on a journey. For some time now, I've been endeavouring to give myself some uncharted time on a daily basis. And it still doesn't always come naturally. If I'm working on the computer at my desk, I find it enjoyable and simple enough to stop and take small gaps of half a minute or so at intervals during the day and just look out the window at the sky and at the plants and at the natural world. However, if I've got in my mind the idea of maybe taking half an hour to just sit and do nothing, that's much more challenging. I often experience this uncomfortable quality when the mind is still wanting to do. And sometimes I just simply am unwilling to bear with the discomfort. I'm unwilling to bear with sitting through the discomfort because it will change, it does change. But if you don't sit through it, it won't change. Recently, though, I have discovered that lying on my bed with my legs up against the wall, seems a very straightforward way for me to stop having more input from the outer world for a while. So the thing is to find out what might work for you. And on a solitary I did earlier this year, it was a couple of weeks, and I did notice that about halfway through the retreat, I just very happily just sat in the chair in the hut doing nothing. It was like it built up that sense of the enjoyment of doing nothing. So I think, like anything, it's practice is the thing, and one has to go through the discomfort. But given our need to examine more closely what is actually going on in experience, as opposed to what we habitually assume to be happening, these intentional gaps and spaces are important until we are naturally more attuned to the way things are. Another practice I've taken up to help cultivate spiritual receptivity is bowing. Getting down on my knees on a daily basis and bowing to various depictions of the truth that I've got displayed in my bedroom. Really letting my head touch the ground and staying there with an open heart and open mind. Putting myself, as it were, in the mudra of not knowing and willingness to receive. In the same lecture where Bhante talks of our need to hold ourselves open to higher spiritual influences, he suggests that one of the ways we can become more spiritually receptive is prayer. And this attitude of prayer features in puja, particularly the section in the Sevenfold Puja entitled Entreaty and Supplication. Although really the whole ritual is a form of prayer, including mantra recitation. So in such a ritual, we're giving focus and expression to our aspiration to grow, to develop, to become wise and compassionate, like the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, while simultaneously recognizing we cannot do this on the basis of self-willing. I go through phases of doing a fair amount of mantra chanting, and for me this is definitely a form of prayer. I'm invoking a particular archetypal Buddha or Bodhisattva, calling upon them, if you like, and at the same time opening up to them through the medium of sound and colour, principally. So the form of the mantra and the colour of the figure communicate meaning to me. There's beauty, there's truth, and there's goodness here. I mentioned at the start of this talk that twice now I've read out loud the entire Gandavyuha. This is a remarkable experience. On both occasions, I read for about an hour or so each evening for 28 days. and I treated it a bit like a bedtime story and made sure I was sitting nice and comfortably. I think this is important if you're going to really get into something that in some respects is quite demanding. The material is demanding to engage with, and you need to feel as relaxed as possible. And yes, as the days passed, I began to feel I was living inside the world of the sutra. And what a mind-expanding world that is. And of course, there was resistance at times. Just the sheer number of words can provoke resistance. But again, my experience was that if I just kept going, well, one goes through the resistance and one enters a flow. And at the very least, that flow becomes dhyanic, and sometimes it was more than that. So whilst the recitation was active, at the same time I was taking in the significance of what I was reading and letting it do its magic. So there was that opening, that receptivity. And because I was unfamiliar with the sutra, I mean, even if one's read it many times, you don't remember everything. It's like there was definitely that sense of going into the unknown. You just didn't know what the next page was going to bring. So all the activities I've mentioned so far, which support the emergence of the unbounded energy of the creative mind, involve receptivity and help us to cultivate receptivity. Meditation, puja, chanting, recitation, reflection, doing nothing, being still, being silent, appreciation of nature. I could also mention appreciation of music and the other arts. And they can be practiced on one's own, but of course, they can also be practiced. All these things can be practiced with other people. Now, they're powerful when practiced on our own. They can be even more powerful when practiced with others in the Sangha. And I'll come back to this a little later on. Just now, I want to briefly touch on the system of spiritual life we offer and practiced in Tri Ratna, which we're looking at once again in this series of talks, and the place of spiritual or dharmic receptivity within that. And I'm then going to return to looking further at how this receptivity connects to spiritual community. So this system comprises five stages. We've probably all just about remembering them now, because we've been talking about them quite a lot over the last year here. Integration, positive emotion or skillful intention, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and finally, the stage of no more effort or spontaneous compassionate activity, which of course sounds incredibly attractive. So it's something to look forward to. So this is broadly based on the Mahayana scheme of the five paths. Going back to our story about Sudana, his journey culminates in his meeting with and total embrace of the vows of Samantabhadra. In effect, he becomes one with the archetypal bodhisattva, Samantabhadra, or universal good. So this is the stage of spontaneous compassionate activity. So a few years ago, we began to make more explicit in our teaching at Tri Ratna centres that the elements of this system can be considered not only as a hierarchy, beginning with integration, but also can be considered as aspects of spiritual life and practice that we need to keep revisiting and cultivating again and again as we move through these stages. And moreover, they're aspects or elements of practice that apply to all areas of our life. They're not just concerned with what happens when we're sitting on the meditation cushion. So when looked at in this way, the vertical stage of no more effort or spontaneous compassionate activity corresponds to the horizontal aspect of spiritual or dharmic receptivity, which in a meditative context is epitomised by the practice of just sitting. So our practice at every level and in all activities of our life need to embrace these five elements. And they can be seen as the principal elements of the Dharma life, from the practice of a newcomer right through to the activity of a Buddha. Vasantra, in a talk he gave to the order in 2012, suggests that if we look at the system of spiritual life as a mandala, then spiritual receptivity is right at the centre of the mandala. So at the heart of the spiritual life is this open, receptive awareness that is not seeing everything in terms of its use or value for self, but values, appreciates and enjoys things, people and qualities for their own sake. So because I feel Vasantra describes very well how receptivity comes into play within these other aspects of spiritual life, I'm going to quote him verbatim from his talk. Okay, so this is Vasantra. Being at the centre of the mandala, this open, receptive awareness is then supported by the four sides: integration, positive emotion, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. However, the metaphor of support isn't quite right, as spiritual receptivity isn't separate from them, it pervades them all. They are the areas in which spiritual receptivity functions. Without it, there would be no path and no mandala. After all, integration requires openness to our actual experience, rather than our concepts about it. It requires us to move into our experience of ourselves as embodied, into our feelings and so on. Integration also requires openness to the ethical dimension of life and response to spiritual qualities. Positive emotion entails receptive, open awareness to ourselves and others. It especially involves empathy, being receptive to others as living beings like ourselves. Becoming aware of how, just like us, living beings are subject to illness, growing old and death. And how we all long for happiness and try to avoid suffering. Spiritual death, insight into reality, involves an open receptivity to how things really are, which also involves curiosity and questioning the assumptions that we bring to our experience, including all our assumptions about the me that is seemingly having the experience. And spiritual rebirth requires deep receptivity, profound openness to what goes completely beyond our everyday experience, receptivity to the teaching and example of the Buddha Shakyamuni, to the spiritual influence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, to the Dharmakaya, the nature of reality itself. It involves throwing open the shuttered windows of our little ego hut and allowing the light and the rain of blessings of the Dharma to pour in. Spiritual receptivity is central to all aspects and all stages of spiritual life. So thank you to Vasantra. That's very well put. So spiritual receptivity is an attitude or quality of mind, a quality of being, an openness to being more than one has been, an openness to growing beyond who one is now. And just as one is open to becoming more oneself, so too is one open to others becoming more than they are now. This is what spiritual community is essentially about. Indeed, it's the raison d'etre of its existence. A spiritual community that doesn't support and encourage the growth of the individual is a contradiction in terms. Bhante speaks of the defining principle of the spiritual community as being freedom to grow. We come together with others in the Sangha on this basis. We want to grow and change. Others want to grow and change. We can help one another to do this. We can learn from one another. We can encourage and exhort one another. We can enjoy and appreciate one another. And as we learn ever more effectively how to transform ourselves in accordance with the karmic and dharmic orders of conditionality, we become better equipped to be of true benefit to other people. So working with the karmic order of conditionality is working within the context, particularly of ethics. And a sense, we're working with the fact that we are experiencing a self and we are experiencing others. And within that context, we can become ever more skillful. We can cultivate increased skillfulness through body, speech and mind. We can bring benefits to ourselves and other people through becoming more skillful. However, the truth is far subtler and more mysterious than our dualistic worldview. In reality, we don't have a self which stands apart and separate from the rest of life. Eventually, if we wish to follow the Buddha's footsteps all the way, we'll need to gradually let go or see through our self-identity, however positive and skillful and refined it may have become. And this involves opening up more and more deeply and fully to the dharmic order of conditionality, to that which lies beyond the self-grasping mind. The dharmic order of conditionality is a creative principle that comes into play when we get out of the way. It's what Bhante is referring to in more poetic language when he speaks of opening up to higher spiritual influences streaming through the universe. So a first glimpse or intimation of the truth comes to us from beyond the range of the conceptual mind, unbidden and often unsought for. And it's what eventually brings us through the doors of a Buddhist centre such as this one. Sooner or later, we realise we do not know. As Bhante says in Wisdom Beyond Words, in a sense, it doesn't matter what else you are, but you must be spiritually receptive. We have to be willing and ready to learn. When we know that we do not know, everything is possible. And I'm reminded here of Padmasambhava's advice. I do not have, I do not know, I do not understand. Let these three phrases be reflected on again and again. I do not have, I do not know, I do not understand. So we arrive in this situation with other people who have also realised, at least to some extent, that they do not know. And this is the beginning of a great adventure, a great journey. Many, many years ago, Bhante dropped into our midst the idea of the 11-headed, 1,000-armed form of Avalokiteshvara being a symbol of the order. This image and the myth which lies behind it are an attempt to convey not only what we're brought up against when we begin to truly open to the vast and all-encompassing range and depth of the suffering of beings in conditioned existence. It also symbolically suggests where or how the solution arises, a necessarily suprapersonal, transcendent solution which arises from the depths of reality. It's not a solution we can rationally grasp. Rather, it's a truth which we must learn to live. And one of the key ways of learning to live it is through the practice of spiritual community, where our individual aspiration to grow and develop, where our individual efforts to alleviate suffering, where our individual efforts to be receptive to higher spiritual truths are augmented, strengthened, and enhanced through entering into communication in various ways and through various mediums with other individuals similarly motivated, where we go beyond self-clinging through deeper engagement with one another. This is really what the Triratna Order, a wider community, is essentially about, is essentially concerned with. To become a real force for good in the world. And I think we're not overstating things in saying that to some degree it already is. Indeed, the more we wake up to what we're really about, individually and collectively, the more the bodhicitta will live among us and inform what we do. Each and every coming together of members of the spiritual community is an opportunity to open more to the mystery which lies beyond the known, the graspable, the familiar. It's an opportunity to engage with one another from the standpoint of not being fixed, unchanging beings. To the extent we're able to do this, something new, something fresh comes into being. I've already mentioned the power of collective practice, such as performing puja or mantra recitation together or meditating together. Then there's simply being silent together with relaxed, open awareness. Engaging in Dharma study and discussion, we learn to listen deeply to one another as well as the words of the teachings we're contemplating. And then there's all the various ways we can participate in Sangha at a centre such as this. Working on a project such as a fundraising event, creating a shrine for a festival day, being on a team for a meditation or Buddhism class, organising a retreat, living in community with one another, working in team-based right livelihood together, singing in a choir, walking in nature, going on retreats with one another. Really, the possibilities are endless of the ways we can come together with others in the Sangha. And all these ways of engagement offer potent opportunities for letting go self-clinging, opening to, being receptive to the unknown, the unfamiliar. We have so much to learn from one another. On this spiritual journey, we're all on, alone, yet together. Indeed, in dependence upon this coming together of shared aspiration, it's possible for something quite wonderful to arise. First conceiving an I, we cling to an ego. Then conceiving a mine, we cling to a material world. Like water in a water wheel, helplessly we circle. I bow down to the compassion that arises for all beings. Thank you.